Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
If you live in the United States, being black might be bad for your health. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking averages here, of course, but a number of very serious diseases, like diabetes, high blood pressure, and lung cancer, strike African Americans at higher rates than white Americans. And diseases like asthma and stroke cause a higher percentage of deaths among black people. As a physician himself, and as a black man with a personal history of high blood pressure and kidney disease, my guest has spent much of his career trying to understand the complex reasons why. Dr. Damon Tweedy is assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical School and staff physician at the Durham VA Medical Center. His new book is called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Dr. Tweedy, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Welcome.
Martin Luther King, as you write in the book, said that of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health is the most shocking and inhumane. That was 1966, when the country was still working to fully integrate the healthcare system. What did you find when you entered medical school 30 years later?
Yeah, so, you know, that statement was made 2 years after the Civil Rights Act had passed, 1 year after the Voting Rights Act had passed. And so that statement really sort of shows the centrality of health, how important health is to all of us. And I think it also was a statement to, in the ways in which health is influenced by things beyond simply healthcare and medical treatment. So I think it's a sort of a complex statement if you think about it. Now, when I entered medical school 30 years later, 1996, to be honest, I had somewhat of a post-racial mindset. Just what race was something that I was certainly aware of, but I was maybe even trying to escape by going into medicine. I saw medicine as a very objective. This is the way that I saw it. I thought it was going to be something that would be very objective. And when I got to medical school, there was somewhat of a rude awakening.
Yeah, this is fascinating. You write that whenever your class would discuss medical problems that plague black people at greater rates than other races, it caused you to feel insecure. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. So, you know, I come from a working class background. I'm from Washington, D.C. area in a town in Maryland, and it was an all-black suburb. And I'd gone to a state college, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. So I'd gone to a state college and you know, very good program that I was in. It was called the Meyerhoff Scholarship Program. But then when I came to Duke, Duke was a very, you know, elite private school. Many of my classmates were children of doctors and lawyers and professors. My parents had not gone to college. And so there was already this insecurity that I was bringing from the very beginning. And then as we started to sit in class, and every time you'd hear up a lecture, you'd learn, well, this disease is more common in black people. And black people who get this disease do worse. So it would always be those two statements, at least one of those two statements for every disease, sometimes both statements. And so there was, so I was already coming to medical school with this insecurity, and that just sort of really just hammered at in a totally different way at a much deeper level. So that was sort of the dilemma that I faced. Now, when you learn about these diseases, so the next question to me was, well, why is this the case? Why are these diseases more common? Why are the outcomes worse in black people? And there I didn't seem to get answers. And so that's really one big part of the book, is really trying to explore the many reasons why that this is so.
And there are a number of reasons that you explain to us throughout a number of case studies in the book.
Sure.
There are systems-based disparities that limit black
Sure.
people's access to medical care. Why is it harder for black people in America to access medical care?
Sure. So I'll take a step back. So this is, even though we're talking about issues that have this sort of system and political kind of context, this is very much a personal book, very much a personal story. And so what I'm doing is throughout the book is use personal examples of patients that I saw. Sometimes I'm the patient, but often it's me as a medical student, doctor, seeing patients, and I use their stories to really illustrate these larger problems. So it's very much a narrative kind of book. And so to the first question about the system, I think an obvious example for me was early in medical school. Here I am. We volunteered at a rural charity clinic. This is about 90 minutes away from campus. And there the patients were all black. It was the eastern part of North Carolina in the community. The patients were all black. Most of them did not have health insurance at all. And you could see pretty clearly how that drove everything. So you didn't have health insurance, you're in poverty, and how you don't have access to doctors, you don't have access to care. And then the kind of care that we were providing to them was pretty substandard. I mean, they can't afford the medications they need, the lab tests. And so it's really clear that there were larger system-based issues that were impacting people on an individual level. And so that was one of the first discoveries that I had in medical school.
There was one woman that you were treating there. It's such an interesting example, even though it seems like a very small story. She
Sure.
had said she was taking a water pill. You were trying trying to figure out what this meant. She said, right. It's a small orange circle. And you're like pulling right. your hair out because that doesn't give you any information that you need.
Right. As a medical student. Right. So, I mean, you know, maybe as a pharmacist, it might have. But as a medical student and doctor, you know the names of the medicines. You know how they work in the body, but you don't really know what they look like. And so the patient has a completely different orientation. Right. So particularly the one that I saw and many of the kinds of patients that I would see where, you know, they know what it looks like, but they may not know the meaning of what the medicine is and how it works and all those sorts of things. So it's almost like you're trying to you're communicating in two different languages. And so a lot of medicine, a lot of the story is about that doctor-patient relationship and how we can all get on the same page. And that's a lot of what the book's about and how so often African-Americans tend to are less likely to be on that same page with the doctor. And so that's a big part of the book.
The other thing about working in that clinic was that because it was sort of run on the cheap, there weren't a lot of resources, you didn't have nurses there. And I wonder how that affected your experience in caring for patients, having to do some of the things that ordinarily would have been done ahead of time before you walked into the room to begin serving as a physician.
Well, as a medical student, it's actually a great experience. I mean, so you know, Duke and many other schools in North Carolina sort of established these kind of relationships with several poor communities in the eastern part of the state. And really, I mean, so on the one hand, it's like a give and take. So on one hand, the community is getting access to doctors and students that they may not otherwise have had. So, you know, because this is the town where there are no doctors there, very poor again, sort of isolated geographically. And so that's what the town is getting in the way. And from the student end, you know, you're getting access to really learning hands-on medicine, you know, out in the real world. And so I think for me, it was actually, you know, a good thing because you're learning how to measure blood pressure and do all the real basic things that nurses so often do in a medical setting. But at the same time, if you take a step back, you realize from the patient's point of view, this is not necessarily the ideal way to receive medical care.
So you were very much wanted at Duke. You were a full mm-hmm. scholarship student.
Sure.
But that didn't keep you sometimes from feeling like you didn't belong there, despite the fact that you had, you know, terrific grades and test scores. And when you got to Duke, you did quite well in medical school.
Yeah, so Duke, you know, as many medical schools throughout the country, not just those in the South, but really nationwide, you know, certainly there's this history of having very few African-American students. I mean, many of the top medical schools didn't really start to integrate in any real significance until the late 60s, early 70s, really. And so for many years, you know, Duke, like many schools, particularly those in the South, struggled with getting African-American students on board. And so Duke decided sometime in the early 90s to begin a scholarship program to really sort of entice medical students, African-American students in larger numbers to come to the school. So at the time that I was arriving there, it was sort of the first class that really had a sizable, sort of a large number of African-American students, about 13, which is about the out of 100, which is about the proportion, you know, nationally in terms of the black population. So that was a big change from how it had previously been. And so I think that created some tensions for sure. So I think, you know, so one example I talk about in the book is as a first year student walking into a classroom and a professor, he comes up to me in a sort of angry, irritated way. And, you know, he asked me to fix the lights in the classroom. And
as if you were the janitor or somebody that was there.
Yeah,
exactly.
So I was baffled by that, of course. But then he mentioned then that he said, I called about this the week before. Why haven't you done this? So it was really a serious case of mistaken identity. And, you know, my first thought was that maybe I'd done something wrong, that maybe I dressed the wrong way, or maybe I hadn't shaved or something that was, you know, something I had done that to cause that reaction. That was sort of my internal initial response. But then, you know, I thought about it a little bit more and realized, you know, there was another way in which I sort of stood out and was different. And so I talk about that in the opening chapter of the book and sort of how I responded to it. And that's certainly one of the issues where you see that every medical student has these issues that they struggle with, but there's a whole other layer by being an African-American person. And so the book also talks not only about the history about black patients and their struggles in the healthcare system, but also what it's like to be an African-American doctor and medical student and sort of be different in some ways.
That professor never did say to you, Damon, I'm so sorry for the mistake I made. Did that surprise you?
Well, I mean, so as I talk about in the story, the way I responded to this sort of what I perceived as a, you know, pretty significant slight or insult, if you will, I'd grapple with, well, should I report this? No, if I do that, other people might think they won't understand where I'm coming from. They might think that I'm being, you know, hypersensitive or paranoid or something like that. So the way that I thought I could best handle the situation was to just excel and really to study round the clock nonstop for several weeks. And at the end, I got one of the, you know, the highest grade, second highest grade in the course. And I went and talked to him at the very end of the course. And, you know, first, again, he was surprised. I think he was this sort of this, I think he recognized him, but there was this surprise that this person, me, had done as well as I had. And so there was sort of like a disconnect. I think he was trying to, you know, make sense of, because he looked at my ID badge and then looked at me and tried to make sure it was, we were one and the same, looked at the exam score and made sure we were one and the same. I think, but then once he realized it was the case, I think there was another switch that changed. Another light went off in his head and he's like, wow, this guy must really be amazing if he can do this as a black person. And so then he offered me a position in his, to work with him. And so I ultimately decided to not do that. I felt like there were other options I could have. And because I felt like he couldn't actually apologize, but probably offering me a position was his way of apologizing, but he couldn't just come out and say that.
Yeah. Well, you write that you'd been, you felt like you were affected by this phenomenon that's been called black, best black syndrome. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, so that's really this whole idea. That's kind of what I was alluding to in the previous example, is this idea that I think it's ingrained in so many of us, African-Americans included, that African-Americans are somehow less capable academically or intellectually. And I think it's ingrained to so many people that when there's an African-American person who does do well, as well as a white student or an Asian student, there's sort of this perception that, wow, they must really be amazing and that they must be something really special. And we got to have this person. And so I think there's sort of this phenomenon where it's replicated throughout schools all across the country, where they're sort of competing for people that African-Americans they sort of perceive in this way. And so I think that's, you know, it's certainly a good that comes to that. There's advantages for me, but there's also this sort of underlying perception that you're less capable, and that in order to succeed in this level, you must be amazing. So it's sort of a condescension at the same time that there's a acknowledgement of your success.
And you had that coming to you on two levels, because you are also a talented athlete. So you had teachers in high school who were surprised that you could be a good athlete and an excellent student at the same time.
Yes, that happened all the time. Now, you say talented. I'm not sure about how talented I was, but certainly I was, you know, I'm very tall. So I'm 6'6". And the area I grew up in, basketball was sort of ingrained in your DNA from birth almost. It was like the thing to do. And I did play basketball in high school and was a good player in high school. And yeah, there was this perception that, wow, if you're a good athlete, that's what you're supposed to do anyway. You know, you're an African-American, you're tall. Hmm. Basketball is what you're supposed to do. And, but at the same time, if you're a really good athlete, then that means you can't be a good student. And so I certainly encountered that. Even one time a coach, we were talking about college recruitment and playing basketball in college. And he questioned whether I could score high enough on the SAT to qualify for college, even though I had the straight A average, and all other students who had those averages, straight A averages in the class, you know, scored really well in the SAT. But somehow there was this perception that I couldn't do that. So those sort of situations arose a lot throughout my adolescent and early years.
You mentioned that your parents didn't go to college. Your older brother did. Can you talk about how his trajectory through school influenced yours?
Yeah. So, I mean, the neighborhood I grew up in, there were very few models of African-American success from an academic perspective, very few models. Really, as I mentioned, sports was the way to go. If you were going to get out of the neighborhood, you're going to play football or basketball and go to college that way, particularly as a man, African-American man. And so I had this one example of my brother. So my brother's 10 years older than me, and he was really one of the few people in the neighborhood and in my extended family, my entire family, who had gone to college strictly on academics. And so that was an enormous example for me as a young kid thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. And to have this example in my own home, I can't give him enough credit for how that helped shape my own, you know, destiny in a way.
My guest is Dr. Damon Tweedy, assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical School and staff physician at the Durham VA Medical Center. His new book is called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Damon Tweedy, who is assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical School and staff physician at the Durham VA Medical Center. His new memoir is called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Damon, you're in medical school. You guys are learning how to take blood pressure and heart rate and all that, and you're practicing on each other. And your result comes back, and it's really alarming.
Yeah, so during that first year of medical school, we're learning again about how all these diseases are more common in Black people, heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, and how Black people have worse outcomes when they're diagnosed with these conditions. So during that first year, my grandmother died about a month into that first year of medical school, and she died from heart failure related to high blood pressure and all these sorts of things. So what we were learning academically had a personal meaning to me, but that took on a whole nother level about 6 months later when we were practicing and learning how to do the real basic stuff, checking blood pressure, heart rate, et cetera. And a classmate found that my blood pressure was very high, 150, 160, the top number, bottom number, 95, something like that. So quite high. The cutoff is 140 over 90 for diagnosis of high blood pressure. And, you know, she checked a few more times. It stayed high. And then about a week or so later, I went to see one of the family doctors on campus in a student health clinic. And the blood pressure was again very high, about the same as before. And not only that, whenever someone comes to the clinic with high blood pressure, you're going to check some blood tests, some urine tests to check how their kidneys are working. And what they found was that there were some signs of early signs of kidney disease associated with this high blood pressure. So that's a common outcome of high blood pressure is kidney disease. And so it just hit me like a ton of bricks. You know, I'm 23 years old this time. I've been a college basketball player. My body mass index is normal. You know, I'm a pretty thin guy. Thought I was healthy, and blam, here we go.
Yeah.
What you learn in the textbook is now applied to me.
Right. And then there had to be this sense, not only of like, why me? Because I look healthy, I feel okay. But like, you don't have time to be dealing with this chronic health problem, which I guess is true for everybody, right? Who's diagnosed with something that is serious and requires care over the long term.
Yeah, but as a doctor, you know, you're thinking there's a certain sense of being a doctor, a medical student, that you feel indestructible in some ways.
Yeah.
Young people feel that way often anyway. There's a certain aura to being a doctor where you feel that way even more, perhaps. And so for me to face that at that age, you know, 23 was like, it was really shocking. And again, it sort of brought back this whole idea about race. And so is it because I'm African-American that I'm having these problems? Because I do have a family history of high blood pressure. And so what do I do with all this information? So that was kind of where my mind was at that point.
You write about the fact that within your own family, you know, sometimes people assume that segments of the population who have higher incidences of disease simply don't understand any of the information about it. Within your own family, there were lots of discussions, you know, among folks who had experienced high blood pressure about the way everybody was eating. It's not necessarily always easy to do things, but it's not people shouldn't assume that the idea is that no one has any information about these conditions.
No, yeah, I agree with that. I wouldn't make that assumption that you don't have information, but I do think it's important to understand people's context and where they're coming from. And so for me, you know, one of the challenges that I had in managing my blood pressure, because the book talks a lot about sort of what that was like when I first got diagnosed and how I dealt with it and how I struggled to deal with it, you know, over time. And so it's a narrative that sort of kind of goes throughout the entire book, you know, peppered in with other stories. And so for me, there was this huge struggle with how to do. Like, I had the information. I was a medical student. I was a doctor. And I was still struggling to make the changes that I needed to make. And what was that about? Why was it so hard? So one hand, change is hard for everybody, right? But there's this whole other piece that was sort of a racial and cultural aspect to that I found myself struggling with, like in terms of how to choose foods and the idea of eating certain foods but had always kind of associated with that with being something that healthy or well-to-do white people would do. And then there was a kind of food that I grew up eating. And so there was this sort of disconnect and this idea that going from one type of food to another meant more than just simply the taste of it or the change of it, but also sort of this idea that it meant some aspect of like shedding cultural identity and giving something up. I mean, and so it's a really complicated mindset that I was struggling with. And I think that's something that I've now that I've experienced it and understand it, I've talked with a lot about it with African-American patients and tried to help them work through these issues as well. So it's not so much that they don't know some of these things, but like there may be other barriers that are in the way. And so I think as a physician, it's important to be able to explore that and give people room to discuss those issues.
Can you talk about this concept of cultural competence, the idea that physicians, no matter what their background, need to be able to relate to, communicate effectively with patients from wherever they have come to make sure that the information gets across and that they've conveyed a sense that they actually care about what happens to this person?
Well, so here's the reality. So, you know, about 13% of the population is African-American, and among physicians, about 4% of physicians are African-American. So African-American patients are certainly going to be seeing doctors who are not African-American majority of the time. And even if we did have somehow the exact number of African-American doctors is proportionally, I don't think the goal would necessarily be that every black person is going to see every black doctor and black patient to match them up in that way. And so you're going to have these cross, you know, racial interactions. And so I think it's really important to be able to understand different cultures, obviously, but also to still at the same time to not use that as a way, as a means to stereotype and to bias people, to have bias against people, but as a way to understand people, but still search for their individuality and find ways to connect with them. So cultural competency is often described as just simply being you understand this culture and you understand certain norms about the culture. I think that's only part of it. I think really the other part of it is still it's a piece about how to connect with people as individuals and be able to sort of integrate their culture with them as individuals and work with that in a way together to help that patient achieve the best outcome.
There's a point where you talk about meeting a new patient and I guess he's telling you about his life. And was he talking about going to Vegas and gambling or something? And there was part of you that wanted to leap in and make sure he didn't have like a gambling problem or a drinking
sure.
problem. And then you thought, no, wait, I have to stop here and meet this person first as a human being. And then we'll get to that other stuff.
Yeah, so I think my experience as a black physician is instructive. So often when we talk about cultural competency, we're talking about white, you know, traditionally we're talking about a white physician and a black patient. That's sort of how it's kind of evolved, or a white physician and a patient who's foreign from another country and has language barriers. Those are what we often think about when we say cultural competency. But it really can apply in any dynamic where the doctor and patient have different backgrounds. So me as an African-American doctor, many of the patients I see are Caucasian or white. I mean, at least half of the patients I see are white. And so oftentimes there may be cases where the patient comes in with preconceptions about me and about my competency or my, you know, my ability to be a good doctor. And I may have questions about them, you know, or preconceived biases or stereotypes about them that often aren't, that may not be favorable. And so there's this one story I talk about in the book towards the end of the book where, yeah, this is a white, young white gentleman who's a war veteran and has a very different background than I do in almost every way you can imagine. And so there's this tendency to want to like label and stereotype and just diagnose people when they seem different than you, and rather than trying to connect with them. So I use that story as an example of how we were able to still find a connection. And once we found that connection, then we were able to really establish the kind of doctor-patient relationship that allowed him to have the best outcome possible. And I think that's a lesson that's instructive for all scenarios where there's a doctor and a patient who are of different backgrounds.
So, Damon, you tell a horrendous story of a white patient and sort of his whole extended family, and they were very racist initially. And I mean, they were very racist, full stop. They
sure.
treated you very badly initially, and then you sort of worked through it. I suppose knowing what this book was about, I expected a story like that. I did not expect the one that you told not too far in the book from that story about a black patient who thought, I don't want a black doctor because this doctor must somehow not be as good as a white doctor.
Yeah, so those two patients really, I saw them right around during the same period. So this is my internship year. This is that first year as a young doctor when you have an MD behind your name, but you don't really feel like you're a full-fledged doctor because
yeah.
you're so inexperienced and you're just learning the ropes. And so there's always just the challenge of being a doctor in that setting, and it's really trial by fire for every doctor. But for me, as an African-American doctor, there were other layers added to it. And so the one case was where there was this older white man who was quite racist in terms of his language he used in describing how he did not want a black doctor. He used the N-word and those sorts of things, and how he didn't want any other black people taking care of him. And so the book talks about, you know, how that story evolved and how I dealt with him, and not only him, but his family, who sort of they presented themselves as Confederate flag attire and tattoos and those sorts of things, all things that sort of seemed threatening to me, and how I dealt with that situation. But at that same time, during that same period, I had a African-American patient who also questioned my competence simply by virtue of me being black. And so to really understand that, it caught me by surprise. It did and it didn't. because there's a history of, you know, of segregation in our country, and how during that time of separate and unequal, I think there's a mindset that evolved not only among white people but among blacks as well, that things that were black were sort of less than or not as good. And so there's certainly this mindset that I was familiar with, like, whereas a black person may not want to, they may not be less trusting of a black, you know, merchant or something like that compared to a white merchant or a Jewish merchant. There are all those sorts of stereotypes that kind of filter down into the community level. And so this patient was basically expressing those views in a very abrupt and blunt sort of way. So I was certainly taken aback. But again, the book talks about how I worked through that and how I was able to sort of, you know, make peace with that, and with that not only for me, but also with the patient, and to make the best interest of the patient in the end. But certainly there are all these different layers that you find as a black doctor that you encounter, that, you know, in addition to all the other difficult things about being a doctor in general.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's a hard enough, demanding enough, exhausting enough job to begin with, to also sure. have this, you know, carry around this backpack of not being sure what you're going to find when you walk into a room, because people might be judging you according to your sure. race. I would imagine that's something that at least white doctors in America have to deal with less often.
Yeah, so I mean, there are certainly scenarios where it may come up. Like, for instance, I mean, you can imagine a white doctor going into a room with a black patient. The black patient might have preconceived mistrust of that doctor. So that could be an instance of the white doctor may have to sort of win that patient over. You could certainly see that happening. Or maybe if there's a sort of a gender thing, a male and a female, and maybe the male doctor has to win over the female. You know, you can see those kind of situations occurring. What was sort of the added layer with the black person is there's sort of a presumption of incompetence that you have to deal with, but also this whole idea within the same race. So it's hard to imagine a white patient telling a white doctor that I don't want you because you're white. I mean, it'd be really hard to imagine that happening, right? In a way that it would with a black, in this case, the black patient with me as a black doctor. So there's certainly much more complicated dimensions that occur as an African-American doctor in that situation.
Let's talk about this trust factor. Another reason that outcomes may be worse for many African Americans, health outcomes, is that doctors have negative views of black patients' ability to sort of manage their own health and follow instructions. Mm-hmm. And some black patients mistrust their doctors. Where does that mutual mistrust come from?
Yeah, so there's this whole right, the book talks a lot about this doctor-patient connection. Really, it's all about issues like trust and communication. And so there's certainly, from the patient perspective, from the African-American patient perspective, there's this history of being mistreated by the healthcare system. It goes back, you know, decades, centuries, if you will, where you have times when black patients were treated on segregated wards, where it was pretty clear that there was substandard care being delivered. I mean, that's a legacy that goes into the 60s. There was a Tuskegee study, which is people often know about, which is just sort of the most well-known example of experimentation occurring on African-Americans without their awareness. In this particular case, it was men with syphilis who weren't being treated even though treatment was available. So there's all sorts of history that's there. And so I think oftentimes that still can filter into the modern day when African-Americans may present to healthcare systems that have mistrust or uncertainty, even in situations where the doctor they're seeing has all the best intentions and is giving them the appropriate advice and treatment. They may still feel reluctance to trust that advice. So that's a clear example of sort of how the past can still influence the present. From the perspective of doctors, I mean, yeah, so there's certainly, I think most doctors are well-meaning and well-intentioned, but often in settings where a doctor is in an emergency room or an urgent care clinic where you don't know the patient and you have to make really snap, quick judgments, I think that's where the bias and preconceived notions of a race or people can really come to play. And all too often, African-Americans are seeking health care in settings where it is sort of urgent, emergency room care, urgent care clinics, instead of in a sort of setting where they have a doctor that they can kind of know and get to know. I think getting to know someone is really the antidote for sort of these bias and things that happen. So all too often you'll see in emergency room settings these things play out. And I write about several examples of those in the book.
Well, you know, and it's understandable. One thing I really liked about this book was how balanced you are. You really do consider all sides of a lot mm-hmm. of these issues, and you know, they're not always ones where the correct answer is easily discerned. But, you sure. know, people who work in hospitals, work in clinics, see a large volume of patients. They begin to notice patterns. It's something that we sure. do as humans. But some of those patterns can lead us to conclusions that are incorrect about the individual. And you write about this young woman whose miscarriage seems to have been related to her drug use. A nurse on the staff said something like, well, these crack people don't change. Can you talk about what you think is wrapped up in a statement like that?
Well, I mean, so, yes, there's a lot of things wrapped up in that. So you're talking about a situation where there's a young woman who's pregnant and loses her pregnancy, And so that's a terrible thing. That's a really emotional, gut-wrenching thing to see. Something that, you know, you never forget and really sticks with you. And I think in this particular case, you know, sometimes people, particularly people who have drug problems, many people in the medical community can be very jaded because those patients can often be very difficult to treat. Can be very sort of, they can be combative and deceitful and all sorts of things. And you can often lose sight of what you're trying to do and just sort of perceive the patient as the enemy. And so I think that's what came out in that particular story, where the reaction from the staff was to let's sterilize this person now, because they were kind of upset at what had transpired. And so that was sort of the reflex reaction there. So I think it sort of speaks to a lot of different issues. And there's no doubt that, you know, poverty and race and all those things are sort of wrapped up in that particular scenario that we talked about.
You also witnessed real contrition, real regret in this patient.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really heart-wrenching story. I mean, and this young woman, and so unfortunately, I've seen several people like this. This is just one example I talked about, where you have someone who has really an incredibly dysfunctional background in terms of, you know, childhood abuse and abandonment, neglect, molestation, every sort of bad thing that you can imagine happening to someone, happening to this person. And then them being sort of kind of thrown into society and not really having a way to sort of deal with that. And sometimes just bad decisions are made. And in this case, the bad decision resulted in a very bad outcome in terms of her losing, you know, her pregnancy. And yeah, it was really hard. It was gut wrenching to see her reaction to that is something that, you know, really affected everyone who was there to witness it.
One of the first
unfortunately, I've seen that more than once. That's the really unfortunate part about it.
Hmm. And it was one of the first times you'd ever seen a staff member crying in sympathy.
Yes, because again, it's just the idea of losing, you know, you have a pregnancy that comes to an end in such a dramatic way. And it certainly was the first time. And it's one of the, you know, only other times you would see that is in cases when people are sort of, you know, when death is really occurring. And so that was one of the most gut-wrenching cases that I saw. It was very early in my formative training. So things that happen to you when you're first going through the training process are often the ones that really stick with you the longest.
Yeah.
Because they're sort of the first time you've seen it. And so that story is certainly one that I'll never forget.
Dr. Damon Tweedy is my guest. He's assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical School and staff physician at the Durham VA Medical Center. His new book is called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Duke University Medical School, Dr. Damon Tweedy. His new memoir is called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Damon, can you talk a little bit more about how, over the years, you have learned to keep your own emotional responses in check so that you can do your work, whether that response, that emotion is anger at something that someone has said that is very offensive, or you feel deeply sad, but you really can't let that get in the way. Especially as a psychiatrist, I would imagine that there are a lot of days that feel very much like a roller coaster as you go along with your patients.
Yeah, so part of that is learning. Part of that is a balance you need to strike as a doctor, right? And so part of that is this issue of how do you balance, you know, containing your emotions or keeping a distance from what's happening, but also not becoming detached to the point where you don't feel what's happening. So it's like a balance that you always strike or try to strike. I think there have been times when I've certainly probably been too invested emotionally in situations, and there have been times when I've been too detached. And so you kind of, it's like a pendulum, and you want to kind of find the right sweet spot. And so that's something that I think is a, as you get more experience, you're able to do better. And so that's sort of the struggle there. I think that's the challenge there. I think as an African-American, there's certainly situations where you may want to, there's another sort of struggle you deal with, this idea of how do I respond to the situation? Like, do I call this situation to someone's attention? Do I make it known that this was something that was a racial slight, or do you sort of pick your battles and, you know, take some things and move on? So there's always this sort of internal sort of calculus you have to navigate. And in several examples of the book, I talk about that. In some cases, looking back, maybe I didn't do the right thing. Sometimes I did. And so there's always this sort of added element that you deal with in that regard.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Nita in Cedar Hill. Hi, Nita.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. And hello, Dr. Tweedy. And my question and comment is that I had a great uncle who was part of the Tuskegee experiment that you spoke about earlier. Mm-hmm. And my mother died due to maltreatment in a hospital. We actually sued and won the case. And there was blatant racism and disregard for her health in that situation. And we've noticed in our health care, in our large family, where along the natural lines, we have a real mistrust of the medical system. So I know we need that as part of our overall health treatment process. Sure. So how do you know who to trust in seeking health care? How do we know if someone does care for us? I mean, there's probably not a registry that says this person is a racist, don't go there. So how can you tell?
I think one thing is that it's a great question, first of all, and you know, that sounds like I'm sorry about the things that you described that happened to your family, for sure. I think, you know, it starts with primary care. If you have a really good, like my wife's a primary care doctor. I think if you have a really good primary care doctor, someone that you can trust and build a relationship with, and too often African-Americans don't have that. But if you can start with that, then that person, if they're invested in you, they're far more likely to send you to the kinds of doctors and specialists that would be good for you. And so I think that's sort of the beginning of a doctor-patient relationship, is really having that primary care doctor who's there for you and can really help you navigate the system. So I think that's what we're trying to get more of, but there are a lot of issues there as well as far as getting enough primary care doctors and getting them have access to the right people. But I think that's where it would really begins, with sort of the healthcare system itself. I think that there's also an obligation in some ways from these medical centers to sort of engage with the communities and to help try and build that trust. You know, these sort of large academic hospitals and medical centers that are often in African-American communities or large African-American communities. And so I think there's an obligation there as well.
Is there an ideal size for a practice, a clinic, so that individuals can form relationships when we're talking about sort of primary care and ongoing healthcare functions?
Is there an ideal size? Well, I think it's difficult one to answer. I think a lot of it, I mean, there's certainly pressures for doctors to see more patients and to see them in a shorter period of time. There's certainly a lot of issues there, and that's something that's been talked about a lot over the last, you know, decades, several years, and maybe even decades. I think one issue there is that even if you have time constraints, I think sometimes that can be used as an excuse in some ways, because you can really make a connection with patients often, the best doctors can, even just with a couple questions, a couple minutes. It doesn't really necessarily have to be like a long, drawn-out sort of discussion to help build some foundation of a relationship. So I think that's something I try and model with students. I also teach medical students and young doctors who are training to be psychiatrists as well, and try and teach and model that behavior to them, to see that no matter what field they go into, even if they go into, say, a surgical specialty where you only spend a few minutes with a patient, you can still establish communication and trust with just a few minutes of a dialogue if you do it right.
Knowing that a lot of your students, a lot of the people that you mentor are not African-American, will see black patients over the course of their career, what kinds of guidance do you offer? And do you have to think to yourself, does this sound racist for me to say, listen, when you meet an African-American patient, you might want to consider these three things? How do you have that conversation and convey that you were doing this for the good of the patient and also for the good of the physician in his or her career?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you really, when you see patients, you know, often the student may see them first, and then you go in after and see the student, see them together. And so that's a really good question. I think a lot of it is just sort of this modeling, role modeling. I don't want to sort of inundate them and let them think. I mean, because the important thing is to really learn medicine, right? You need to learn it, but then you also need to understand this other sort of social context to it. And I try and do that in a very careful way. So sometimes I think maybe I don't push the issue enough. Maybe I should even push it more. But certainly, I certainly try to avoid what I would call stereotyping and really trying to, again, get back to that part about the individual. but letting them, but at the same time, the students often really do appreciate when I provide some context on African American history, because many of them are really unaware of some of these things. Like me, we in the African American community often take these things for granted, but many people are totally unaware of some of these issues. And so I do try and shed light on them when I think it's important to do.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have John on the line in Plano. Hey, John.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I'm a long-time listener and first-time caller, and it's an honor to speak with you. And congratulations to the doctor as well and on his success and careers. My question is basically, I want to know what Dr. Tweedy's position would be on colleges lowering some type of, you know, the standards a little bit, whether it's for the standardized test, GRE or MCAT, for African-American applicants, and how he thinks that may affect the perceived lack of competence on professionals with professionals that are black and other races. I'm personally from Haiti originally, and then I went to University of Maryland, College Park, and I was part of the scholar program called the McNair Scholars. You might be familiar with that because I know we have a chapter at UMBC as well. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, I think he was talking about how affirmative action might impact people's perception of you. I think that was the question, right, pretty much?
Yeah.
So I think there's certainly an element to that. But I don't think there's any way to dispute that to some extent. At the same time, I would say that these preconceptions about African-Americans sort of having less competence were around long before affirmative action came around. So I don't think affirmative action, you know, created these issues, even though sometimes it's portrayed that way. What I would say to that is there are a couple things. I think I'm less focused on the idea of affirmative action based on race. I think there's a really big issue with social class and where someone comes from and how important that is. And I think that has real impact. I think, you know, if you come from a certain background the way I did, even irrespective of race, you're certainly at a significant disadvantage when you're comparing yourselves in terms of like test scores to someone. But that doesn't mean, so what's important is not necessarily what your score was when you got to the school, but how you did once you got there. So when I got to medical school, you know, I certainly was one of the top students in the class. And it certainly, I wasn't even being graded on any different scale as any other student. We took all the same tests. And so I think sometimes tests don't necessarily measure future ability as much as they might claim to. So that's sort of how I would respond to that.
Back to the phones now. We have Marion on the line in Plano. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I just had to call because I wanted to relate a story. When I worked in that field, worked in the ER as a nurse, and I'm a Latina, and we had a patient that came in with a broken arm and fallen off of a tall building at work, and the patient was white, and when the physician on call was went in to see him, the doctor was a Mexican-American, and the patient refused to be treated by him, told him not to touch him. He did not want a person like him to treat him. And so he said, fine, I don't want to treat you either then, if that's what you want, you know. And that was it. And that was at the time when they used to be doctors on call. Now the hospitals hire the doctors full-time, and they're working for the hospital full-time. Used to be they had to call the doctor, and he was on call. He had to come up to the hospital. And so they had trouble. They called another doctor, and they had trouble getting another doctor to come in at the time because they weren't on call. So 2 hours went by, and this man was still in a lot of pain. And then he decided, well, since you can't find anybody else, I guess I'll take him then. And the doctor refused. The doctor said, no, you did not want me to take care of you. I think you'd be better off with someone else.
Is there anything about that you can relate to, Damon? That desire to say, forget it.
Oh, there's certainly that desire. I could certainly understand that. And, you know, in my book, I talk about my own experience with that sort of situation, but also there's actually been quite a bit written about that by other doctors, about their experiences. Some women doctors, Asian doctors who've had similar kinds of experiences. And yeah, it's sort of like, what do you do in that situation where the patient doesn't want to see you? So in some cases you can easily find another colleague to do it. It sounds like in that case you probably couldn't. And so that was a real challenge. I like to think as a doctor, you should probably, you know, do the best you can in that situation. But I mean, it's certainly an understandable emotion that doctor felt. I mean, I can certainly relate to that emotion. I'm not exactly sure how I would have handled it myself, depending on the situation.
When did you realize that you felt a special obligation as a Black physician to serving Black patients, whether that means that you serve primarily Black patients or not, that there was something special about your presence within whatever healthcare role you were filling?
Well, you see it in several ways. So one example is that often we were in communities where there's large Black populations. For instance, in Durham, it's about 40% Black. And again, you're one of the few Black physicians, at least in my program. I was one of the few Black physicians. So you would often get these requests. I would often get these requests to see African-American patients, and I'm just one person. So it's like, well, where is my obligation? What is my role in this process? There's this huge need. There's this huge issue. Where do I fit in there? So the pressure was there. I mean, and it was there in many ways. And it's something you struggle with because at the same time, you want to just be a doctor as well. You want to treat other patients of different backgrounds and not just be the Black doctor for Black patients. But there's this other part of you that sort of understands that there's this huge history at work as well. And you feel some obligation. Often patients would say, wow, this is really great to see a Black doctor. I've never seen one before. I feel proud of you. So you almost feel as if you're representing not just yourself, but people that have come before you and people that come after you. So you juggle these different emotions at different times.
What does diversity look like at the Duke University Medical School these days?
It's improved considerably. So in the final chapter of the book, I sort of take stock of where things were 20 years ago and where they are now. Back then, there had never really been any African-American doctors in real leadership positions. And now, I mean, early this year, the chancellor, the top person at the medical school, was appointed as an African-American man. So that's an incredible thing I probably couldn't have envisioned 20 years ago when I first started. And several of the top deans and other leading department heads are women. Again, which is something that had never occurred in the past. So there's certainly been concerted efforts to sort of reckon with the past and make changes. But at the same time, there's still, you know, a lot of work to do. But certainly things are going in the right direction, I would say, compared to how they were 20 years ago.
What do you think is most effective at recruiting more of the best and brightest African-American college students to consider a medical career?
Well, one of the issues is even, well, what do you get before that? So the pipeline is what the term that's often used. You have to find a way to sort of, and this speaks to larger issues in society in terms of educational opportunity at the younger levels and getting more and more people interested in education such that they're on a path where they can even get to college in the first place. And then once they're there, I think it's just an issue of sort of people like myself reaching out to college students and being, I guess in a way, role models, right, or visible examples of what you can do if you do take the medical track. But so much of it just speaks to this issue of how do we get people from the very beginning in education and going in the right direction.
Do you have any thoughts on K-12 education and how, particularly in lower income communities, what would be like, is there a magic bullet or something that would really help?
I don't think there's a magic bullet. I mean, you hear various stories of pockets of places where things are done the right way. You know, there's some examples of charter schools being successful, but at the same time, there's a sort of potential controversy. Do they draw the students away from other schools? So I don't think there's any magic way of fixing this problem. I mean, I think if I could fix that problem, I'd be a very very rich man, I guess. but it's certainly a huge issue, and particularly among African Americans and men in particular. So in medicine, African American women outnumber men in medical school 2-1.
Wow.
Whereas in all the groups, it's like a 50-50 setup. And so it's a huge issue in the African American community, and it's something that we're continuing to reckon with. And I think it speaks to issues at the society from the top all the way down to the community level.
Dr. Damon Tweedy is assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical School and author of Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Damon, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.